Du lyssnar nu på inspelningen av Justin Hansfords föreläsning vid Uppsala universitet den 29 augusti. Föreläsningen gjordes som ett samarbete mellan Arena Idé och Centrum för mångvetenskaplig forskning om rasism vid Uppsala universitet.
First of all, thank you for inviting me. I wanted to give a round of applause to the Center for Multidisciplinary Research on Racism, Mateos and Hanin, for inviting me here today, because it took a lot of work. And it wasn't easy to get me to turn in my paper, because right now in the United States, we have a number of things happening if you keep up with the news, whether it's in Charlottesville or whether it's on the issue of race and policing. We have plenty of things keeping us busy, so to speak. But I'm happy to be able to come here today and talk to you about an issue that's been dominating my life for the last 3 years, and that is the issue of Black Lives Matter and my particular viewpoint on it as somebody who was in Ferguson and who tried to bring the United Nations and the human rights framework to bear on the question of Black Lives Matter. And one of the first questions I want to ask is that a mistake to try to create a human rights movement out of the Black Lives Matter movement? Is that a mistake, or is that something that we should be doing? So what I want to do in, I think, about 20, 25, or 30 minutes before we get to the respondents is to first tell you my story as someone who was in Ferguson when Mike Brown was killed. Secondly, to give you some analysis of the role of human rights lawyering in the Black Lives Matter context. And thirdly, to explore the question of coalition building. Here in Sweden, I know there's a long history of support for movements for racial justice. Great, thanks. And so the question becomes, what would we have to do? What would we have to do to get support for Black Lives Matter to come out of Sweden into the world, especially from the government or from civil society? What would we have to do in order to make that happen? So I think many of you know what happened on August 9th, 2014. My own story is that I was on Facebook and I saw Mike Brown's dead body on Facebook. He was there for over 4 hours. I started getting these text messages from people who were on the scene telling me what was transpiring. And I was amazed. I had already been involved in racial justice activism before even going to law school. And I had been living in St. Louis for 6 years, and I had lived only 10 minutes away from where Mike Brown was killed. And so as I was headed back to my home, I see people in the street, I see people protesting, I start to hear the stories, and it reminded me immediately of a lynching. For those of you who are not familiar with the tradition of lynching in American history, that's when Black people especially were killed, and not only were they killed for the crime of not being submissive enough, but afterwards their bodies were put on display in order to send a warning so that nobody else would make the same mistake of trying to be a person who asserts their humanity as a Black person. And with the way Mike Brown's body was held on display for over 4 hours in that street, to me, that's what I was reminded of. There's a song by Billie Holiday called Strange Fruit, where she uses the following lyrics, blood on the leaves, Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. And she talks about this image of Black bodies on display and what that meant to the community. Now, The infraction itself wasn't, in my view, what changed everything. What changed everything were the protests, because many of you know that black people, especially black youth, are killed almost every day in the United States. And people in the country are killed every day by police. Black people are killed every 28 hours by police, according to the Malcolm X grassroots movement in the United States, almost every single day. But what was different this time was there was a community that was willing to stand up and say, this time we're gonna make it count. This time there's gonna be a response. This time we're not going to let this be swept under the rug. And I was proud to be able to be part of these protests. People started to enter into the streets. They started to say, hands up, don't shoot. There's myself. You can see I'm badly in need of a haircut. But at that time, we didn't care. At that time, we were gonna go out there no matter what they did to us. And of course, you know, the hands up, don't shoot symbol was very meaningful to us for a couple of reasons. Number one, Mike Brown, when he was killed, we were initially told, and many of us, including myself, still believe that he had his hands up in the air. And he was saying, don't shoot. That's what his best friend said. And his best friend was the closest person to the incident. And so I often tell people, if you had hired a consultant and asked them to come up with the perfect protest symbol and perfect chant and the catchiest slogan for a protest, that consultant would have come up with hands up, don't shoot. Because it's simple, it's four words, it's something anybody could do. We were on the street and little kids ages 5 and 6 were coming up to you saying, hands up, don't shoot. People were honking the horns at you and saying, hands up, don't shoot, in their cars. And to me, it was a spiritual thing. You have a 18-year-old kid, his last words become something that becomes a slogan all around the world, and his last action becomes something that people all across the world, all across the country, began to mimic, just like Eric Garner with I Can't Breathe. His last words become a chant that stands the test of time. It becomes something that politicians mimic in the halls of Congress. It becomes something that celebrities mimic at the Video Music Awards. So that hands up, don't shoot moment, to me, was a spiritual moment. At the same time, we know that whenever you're engaged in protest and that protest begins to break the law, especially for the law students in here, you're going to find yourself coming into contact with violence. Because most people who study the law will tell you, at the end of the day, law is violence. Law is violence. When lawyers, judges, prosecutors engage in their rhetorical moves, there's always the threat of the violence of the state to back up their principles and what they say. If not, it would just be poetry, or it would just be something persuasive. Law is about violence. And when these protesters took to the streets and they said, hands up, don't shoot, and people came with tanks and tear gas and rubber bullets, the inevitable violence that would come after any lawbreaking that involved racial resistance, what inspired us was the courage that the people showed and the fact that they continued to come out day after day for over 1,000 days. People in Ferguson continued to protest. However, in many ways, we didn't have a choice. I'm gonna come back to this question again later on in the lecture. We didn't have a choice because there's a principle that one of my heroes, Derrick Bell, a critical race scholar, came up with called the lawful protester's dilemma. The lawful protester's dilemma. oftentimes, if you want to create change that inspires people around the country or around the world, you have to break the law. There also are protests and marches where people get their passes, and they tell the government beforehand, we're going to protest between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. on this road, and we're going to walk in this straight line, and then we turn around and come back. And people go out there, and they point, and they watch, and they go back to their life. If you actually want to make a change, you have to oftentimes break the law. Now, there are people who are able to use the democratic process to create political change. But in a place like the United States of America, when you're dealing with the issue of racial justice and you're in the minority and you're trying to change the hierarchy, you oftentimes don't have access to the democratic process to create change. So you have this dilemma where if you want to break the law, you're going to face violence. But if you want to change things, you have to break the law. So people don't want to be faced with tear gas and rubber bullets when they face up against racial injustice, but oftentimes they have no choice. So here you can see a situation that happened with myself. We were protesting in a Walmart in October of 2014 because in a Walmart, another young black man was killed by a police officer. And that police officer was allowed to go scot-free. His name was John Crawford. I actually was not a protester here. I was a legal observer. You see this stylish neon green hat I have on my head here. It says legal observer for the National Lawyers Guild, which is an organization which trains particularly law students and lawyers, but really anybody, to try to protect people's constitutional rights while they are protesting. So we enter the Walmart. There are a number of protesters, including the founder of Black Lives Matter and others, and they start chanting and putting their hands in the air, saying, hands up, don't shoot. And this is actually a good story for you law students here. It's a 24-hour Walmart. The Walmart is open 24 hours. And the store manager comes out and says, okay, the Walmart is now closed. And the police had told him to say that so that they could then arrest us for trespassing. So they booked us for the same charges as you would book a burglar who breaks into the store after hours. We were trespassers. We broke an entering. So they arrested me and the other protesters. They actually arrested me as a legal observer first, and they arrested the protesters after they got me out of the way. We went to jail. It's an interesting experience being a lawyer and a law professor in jail. All the other prisoners thought they were going to get some free legal advice from me, so they kept me up all night asking me legal questions. There was a guy who had robbed, it was an armed robber who had robbed someone of their car, things like that. I got out the next morning and I taught my personal injury law class, but we faced prosecution from the prosecutors here in this case. They offered us a plea deal of 2 years probation and a lifetime ban from all Walmarts all across the country. And I often tell people, I don't know if that was meant to be a reward or a punishment, because Walmart is known as one of the worst stores in the country in terms of how they treat their workers and also the quality of their goods, to be honest. I hope this is recording, because they need to know that. But you know, this is the type of repression that protesters faced in Ferguson. And as a lawyer, I faced a bit of a conundrum, because I took an oath to uphold the Constitution and to follow the law. And there were members of the bar and members of my law school who didn't like the fact that I engaged in the civil disobedience, notwithstanding the lawful protesters' dilemma. This would have a number of repercussions for me going forward. But these were the types of things that people were engaged in Ferguson. And as a human rights lawyer, we know we had to explore other avenues as well. We engaged in public education. We tried to educate community members of their Fourth Amendment rights. We engaged in social media. This is me with some other famous social media activists, DeRay McKesson and Netta, Elise. We engaged in academic work, raising awareness in the media. We brought a bill before the Missouri legislature and tried to encourage politicians to change the law around the use of force. We spoke before commissions, panels. I even spoke at the president's task force on 21st century policing. Now, really quick, raise your hand if you had heard of any of this stuff before just now. Only those who actually looked at my website, I'm sure, have heard about this. The point I want to make here is all of these legal avenues, I don't want to say they don't mean anything. I don't want to say they're worthless. But the reason I'm here today is because of the protesters in Ferguson who engaged in lawbreaking. It's not because of all of this advocacy and legislative work. So the lawful protester's dilemma is proven by my experiences in Ferguson. When you're engaged in racial justice work, oftentimes the only work that makes a difference is the lawbreaking. So what does that mean for questions of justice and lawfulness? The other issue, of course, we're going to get to is the issue of the role of the human rights corpus in the fight in Ferguson. So another thing that we did was we brought a case before the United Nations Convention Against Torture on behalf of both Mike Brown's family and the Ferguson protesters. The Ferguson protesters were hit with these military-grade weapons, including tear gas, even though all they were trying to do was demonstrate. And it was proven that some of them were beaten while they were in the jails after they were arrested. Some of them were denied their personal hygiene products, some of the women. And so we put that claim together. And we also put a claim together arguing that the use of deadly force against people on the grounds of their race clearly violates the UN Convention Against Torture. I believe it's in the first article of that convention. So Mike Brown's father came with us to the UN, and I was able to help them testify before the UN. This is me with Mike Brown's mother. And she went and she told her story to the entire committee, and she told what it was like to have to stand there for 4 hours while her son's dead body was laying in the street, and how she wasn't allowed to go to the body to tend to him, how they never sent an ambulance, how there were dogs that were going near the body, sniffing at the body while she was standing there in the hot sun for 4 hours. By the time she finished, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And by the end of the convention, the committee found for the first time that police brutality violated the convention. It was happening in the United States. In their concluding observations, the committee found these conclusions. And basically, she was vindicated. This was her chance to get her voice acknowledged. And there's no criminal trial and there's no civil trial. So this was her only day in court. She had to go all the way to Geneva, Switzerland to have her dignity recognized in this legal process. But one of the arguments for using the UN human rights mechanisms is that it gives victims their day in court. It gave Mike Brown's mother her day to allow her voice to be heard. And that was powerful for her. Also, in addition to this, we were able to raise awareness about the case on a global level. And we believe that this might have had an impact on the way that the police responded to future protests. We were worried that police would use deadly force again once the non-indictment decision came down. But we have some internal correspondence from the local police chief and from the Missouri governor, which said that because of these actions that raised awareness about the case, they wanted to be more likely, they were going to be willing to consider the rights of people over the rights of property in Ferguson. So they decided that they were going to be less likely to use deadly force, mainly because they were afraid of public opinion. Not because they were afraid of lawsuits from the UN per se, because of course these decisions didn't directly affect them, but they were afraid of how it would look for them politically. So we believe lives were saved from this action. So that's the second reason that the human rights mechanism may be useful. When it can name and shame human rights violations and change behavior through the shaming process. And so we tried to go to as many human rights mechanisms as possible. We testified before the Inter-American Commission. We had people go and engage in the Universal Periodic Review. And we had people work with the special rapporteurs on freedom of assembly, the UN Decade for People of African Descent has been in touch with us. We tried to reach out to as many UN mechanisms as possible. And what we found is that there's limited resonance on the legal side. And so one of the reasons I decided to come to you today is to ask, well, what does the human rights movement look like outside of its legal boundaries? The human rights movement, if you go back to the anti-apartheid struggle, which is known as one of the most successful human rights movements we've ever had, is something that exists not just on a legal plane, but on the plane of people power. Here we have a sign of someone who is supporting South African freedom here in Sweden. And the reason that that message got to Sweden is because the UN and the human rights mechanisms were things that people felt legitimized that struggle against racial injustice. And Sweden had, at that point, a great deal of sympathy, and there was support from Swedish civil society and from Swedish government. I have here a quote from some of your most well-known politicians, Arthur Parr, I'm just gonna butcher these names. Arthur Parr Westberg went on to found the Swedish chapter of Amnesty International, was someone who set up the Swedish South Africa Committee with the aim of mobilizing Swedish politicians against the South African regime. Quote, "We were extremely energetic in trying to have signatures by leading Swedes from all over the political spectrum," he said. This included conservative politicians and business people in Sweden who were usually resistant to supporting the anti-apartheid movement, but yet and still they were engaged. Olof Palme, social democratic leader and prime minister, was another outspoken critic of South African apartheid. When Nelson Mandela later came to Sweden after he emerged from jail, he recognized these Swedish leaders as people who were significant in his fight against apartheid. So this raises another interesting question. What would it take for Swedish civil society and for Swedish politicians and for Swedish business people to support Black Lives Matter? What argument would we need to make in order to allow Swedish human rights activists to support the movement from a moral perspective, from a political perspective, a meeting with the United States ambassador, the prime minister reaching out to someone in the United States government? What would it take to get this type of engagement today? I want to make one more argument. So in addition to the killings of police, the killings by police of people of color, the extrajudicial killings that take place, We're also in the midst of something that we call mass incarceration in the United States. In the United States, we have over 2 million prisoners. The majority of those prisoners are people of color. African Americans make up about 12% of those who use illegal drugs. Over 40% of those who are in jail for illegal drug use. So there's this narrative out there that blacks are in jail more often because they are people who commit crimes more often. But that narrative does not bear out with the facts. It's often the case that they engage in crime just as often as other people do, except they're punished more harshly for it. There's a story that was told in the Ferguson report of a young man named Mike who was sitting in his car after playing a game of basketball, sweaty, tired. It was hot outside. He was just sitting in his car, relaxing. A police officer comes up, knocks on his door, asks him, what's your name? White police officer, black kid playing basketball. He says, Mike. The police officer says, give me your some identification. Let me see your driver's license. He gives him the license. The license says Michael. And he says, you're under arrest for giving me a false name. This young man ends up going to jail for giving a false name. He was a government contractor. He had a job which entailed not having a crime on his record. He lost his job. This happened about 5 years ago. Was no longer able to support his family, got a divorce, now has a record and is still looking for legit employment 5 years later. His life forever changed based on the Ferguson police intentionally targeting him because of his race. And one could argue he did break the law, but this is the way the law is being applied too often against people of color. It is something that has been argued not only violates the UN Convention Against Torture, but the Inter-American Commission has addressed the issue, CERD has addressed the issue, the ICCPR, and I want to throw one more idea out there. The UN has the Rome Statute, which defines genocide, a crime against humanity, as any denial of fundamental human rights or incarceration committed in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over any other racial group, and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. And I want to propose to you today that the system of mass incarceration of blacks in America through racial profiling is a system designed to create domination of whites over blacks, and it's a system of apartheid, which constitutes a crime against humanity. When I taught a class on Black Lives Matter in the law this past semester, I put all these facts before my students and I asked them, what would it take for you to go through the facts and conclude that the American racial system violates this Rome Statute? Almost unanimously, they said, we satisfy all the elements. The only question is intent. The only question is intent. Is this intentional? Are they doing this on purpose? Or is this something which is accidental? That's the only question they put out there. But with the Ferguson report, with the Department of Justice report on the police in Chicago, Cleveland, Baltimore, over the past 2 years, the Department of Justice has put out almost 600 pages of investigative reports by the federal government against local police departments, proving that not only are these departments violating fundamental human rights, the right to life, the right to freedom of assembly, the Fourth Amendment right to freedom from unreasonable search and seizures, and the right to freedom from racial discrimination, not only are all these rights being violated, but they're being violated on purpose. They're being violated by departments that make jokes about President Obama being similar to a monkey, and they send those jokes to each other. Some of you may have read these Ferguson reports. So we've proved intent over the course of the last 2 years. We've proved intent in a way we've never proved it before. So again, what would it take to get a place like Sweden to support the movement? Is the problem international politics? Is the problem the fear of crossing and getting on the bad side of another individual who's up here on my screen? Is there a place for Black Lives Matter in the age of Trump? And is there a place for coalition building and allyship internationally from people around the world in the age of Trump? Since President Trump has been elected, I'm going to show you this video. People have been emboldened to speak out in ways that they've never spoken out before. This is a video of a commercial that was published a couple of months ago by the National Rifle Association in the United States. Let's see if this plays. So that is the climate in the United States today. We've had a number of actions take place over the course of the last, I think, 4 months by the Trump administration. They've decided to end Department of Justice reviews and investigations of local police departments, renew the war on drugs. They decided to, again, aggressively search for and arrest people who use marijuana. President Trump recently encouraged police brutality in a speech where he said that when putting suspects into their police cars, don't feel like you should keep yourself from accidentally hitting their head against the car door as you push them into their police cars. Of course, we know what happened in Charlottesville, where he felt that there were very fine people who may decide to march with the Nazis. He pardoned Joe Arpaio just about 3 or 4 days ago, who was someone who was slated to go to jail for racially profiling. He's a sheriff who was slated to go to jail for racially profiling Latinos on the border in Arizona. And I think only yesterday they decided to renew the policy of militarized policing against people of color and allowing the use of military-grade weapons once again and to be sent to local police departments. So again, what does it take to make the case that the Black Lives Matter movement is a movement that deserves or should have the support of allies in places like Sweden? And what are the roadblocks to doing so? And I actually want to close on a high note after that display. We had an opinion come from our Supreme Court in June of 2016, and it was astonishing because for the first time we saw that in spite of all the things I've said, in spite of the rise of the alt-right, in spite of the militarized policing, in spite of all of this sadness and all of this oppression, we saw that our message had gotten through to one of the Supreme Court justices, Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She wrote a dissenting opinion, a dissent meaning that she was on the losing side of the debate, yet and still she found the strength to pin these words in this opinion, which was an opinion about police rights to investigate people on pretextual stops. So the right for police to make up a pretext and investigate people and try to find evidence on them. She wrote, quote, "We must not pretend that the countless people who are routinely targeted by police are, quote unquote, isolated. They are canaries in the coal mine whose deaths, civil and literal, warn us that no one can breathe in this atmosphere." And we felt that this was a reference to Eric Garner. They are the ones who recognize that unlawful police stops corrode all our civil liberties and threaten all our lives. Until their voices matter too, our justice system will continue to be anything but. So I wanted to leave you on a positive note to let you know that in spite of all that's happening, these voices for justice are continuing to break through. And in spite of the questions around whether or not the Constitution is enough, whether or not human rights is enough, whether or not what we're doing is enough, there are people in the highest echelons of power who are listening, and I hope that the Swedes listen too. Thank you.